Hi, how are you?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch speaking with.
Yes, nice to talk
to you. And so why don't you introduce yourself for the audience?
Well, I'm Max Essex. I'm a professor at Harvard University. I've been in AIDS research for about more than 30 years, actually. Most of my research now is in conjunction with AIDS in Africa.
And so we are speaking a little less than a week before World AIDS Day, which is an annual sort of inflection point for people in the sort of public health and global health community to, I think, reflect on progress we've made against HIV/AIDS and sort of where what else we need to do. So I guess just to kick things off to you, Max Essex, I wanted to ask you this. So I think most of the information that I receive about our sort of humanity's progress in the global fight against AIDS comes mostly from the NGO community and from activist organizations. And for the last couple of years, there has been a notable uptick in the optimism that this community is professing around where we are in the global fight against AIDS. I think there's sort of no longer this question mark over sort of whether we'll see the end of AIDS, but it's more of a declarative statement that we will see the end of AIDS. And I wanted to maybe just get from you, a hard-headed academic, I guess just sort of a general overview of, to kick things off, of where we are. Is this optimism warranted? And sort of where are we in sort of the global fight against AIDS?
Yes. Well, Mark, I agree that we should be optimistic. And I think apart from the numbers that come out of UNAIDS indicating that prevalence is only going up a little and death rates from HIV/AIDS are going down a lot more, incident infections are going down a lot more, and prevalence rates have to go up a little as long as incidence doesn't go down to zero and we're saving the lives of most of the infected. So that shouldn't be taken as a negative that prevalence is going up a little bit.
Because people are on treatment and so they're living longer,
yes,
right?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So
because people are on treatment and now living very long periods of time on that treatment, and they stay in the group of HIV infected. So you have to reduce incidence, new infections, even more to account for the fact that you're saving lives. That's part of the balance that we happily have to factor in now. And part of the reason I would say I'm quite optimistic is because, quite apart from saving so many lives, we also now have pretty good evidence for dramatically lower incidence, and some of that, of course, is related to treatment in ways that we can use it, often described as treatment as prevention.
Mm-hmm. And this is
so,
the treatment, well, the treatment and the treatment for prevention is a relatively new phenomenon, right? I mean, it's only been the last couple of years that you've seen these scientific studies come out that saying people who are receiving treatment are sort of less likely to pass on the virus to other people. Is that right?
That is correct. I would say maybe 2, 3, or 4 years ago, there were clear suggestions that those approaches should work. But to date, there haven't been a lot of studies in large populations to demonstrate the degree of effect that treatment can have in preventing transmission. And over the last couple of years, there have been several large studies designed either to address treatment as prevention by itself or as part of a package of different prevention interventions, including such things as safe medical circumcision and broad-scale testing and condoms and all of the usual prevention strategies in combination with treatment as prevention. So we should expect that within a couple of years, 3 years, we'll have a lot more data about just how effective treatment as prevention can be, especially if we consider in the context of Africa, where incidence is still highest and there are not as many options for saving lives with the smaller fraction of people that develop drug resistance and might require more expensive drug regimens.
Is one, you know, treatment as prevention, as you said, you know, over the last couple of years, there have been sort of a growing chorus of that treatment as prevention is sort of a new frontier in the global fight against AIDS. But it would seem that sort of one sort of consequence of that realization that people who are on HIV treatment and who are on HIV treatment earlier than sort of currently or previously suggested World Health Organization guidelines are sort of less likely to spread HIV, that more people need to get on treatment earlier, and that is more expensive. Are we, I guess, you know, prepared? Is sort of their funding to realize this vision of treatment as prevention, to get sort of ARVs and medicines to populations sooner than they currently are eligible to receive them?
Well, I hope so. And I would argue that it may not be more expensive, or much more expensive, because one of the approaches we advocate for is treatment as prevention on the basis of high viral load and not just lowered CD4. Lowered CD4, obviously.
I think you should probably explain that to the audience, like what those terms mean.
Yeah.
It's a smart audience, but I don't know if all of them necessarily have advanced degrees like yourself.
Sure. Yeah. The usual criteria that people use throughout the world now for treatment of HIV-infected people is either what's called AIDS-defining illness, which is pretty obvious, or lowered CD4 cell counts. And they are the T helper lymphocytes that are most responsible for the immunosuppression that ends in the disease. And those are the cells that HIV infects first and foremost. But that is an indication of the extent to which those cells have been killed in your body by the virus. At the same time, an even earlier indication of what's happening in your body is the virus load, which simply means the amount of circulating HIV that's in your bloodstream. And the amount of HIV circulating in your bloodstream is usually very high even before the lymphocyte count drops. So lymphocyte count drop is later. And some people have a high viral load long before they have a CD4 lymphocyte drop. And the high viral load is by far the best correlate of how likely you are to infect someone else. So if you treat on the basis of high viral load, as opposed to just reduction of CD4 lymphocyte counts, then you'll pick up people who are most likely to be transmitting the virus to others. And that's a strategy we're advocating and testing now in a large trial in Africa.
And what are you finding? Because I think it's worth to sort of tell users that the current sort of protocols are not based on that. They're based on the CD4 count. They're not based on the viral loads. So what are you sort of seeing in your trials?
Well, we just started the trial, a large one with more than 100,000 adults, on the ground in Botswana 1 month ago. So we don't yet have any results to say how well it will work. But one of the points of rationale for why we're doing it is cost effectiveness. Because if you were to, which is why I started talking about this, because you asked the question quite appropriately, of whether or not we'll ever have enough money to treat people at an earlier stage based on higher CD4 or whatever. And our argument is that many of the people with higher lymphocyte counts don't need to be treated earlier unless they have a high viral load. But if they have a high viral load, and that will be a smaller subset, treating them earlier will prevent so many new infections that it will be cost effective. If you look at the results, this is a hypothesis, obviously, if you look at the results in the sense of cost per infection averted, and not just actual cost to that patient, as opposed to programmatic cost for the healthcare system of the government or the region or however you define it.
But I would imagine that to sort of realize that end goal, you need at first like an injection of funds, right?
Absolutely.
So I guess...
you need enough funds to do the studies and verify it, absolutely.
And then if the studies sort of confirm your hypothesis, then... enough funds to greatly expand the amount of treatment available to people with high viral loads initially.
Yes, although I would advocate for going to people with high viral load as opposed to just universal use of antiretroviral drugs for people with higher lymphocyte counts, as the WHO is now advocating. Mm-hmm. For example, they advocate going to 500 lymphocyte count, CD4. I would advocate for staying at 350 and going to higher viral load instead. Mm-hmm. That would be more cost effective and would not result in any significant loss of life or anything of that sort. I believe that's the hypothesis we're testing, of course. Mm-hmm.
I guess sticking on this funding question, ask you about PEPFAR. I don't know how well sort of the public at large sort of understands the significance of PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which was passed in 2003, I believe, or 2002, 2003, sometime around then, by President Bush. With the support of Congress, and sort of the effect that legislation had on the sort of global AIDS landscape.
Yes, the PEPFAR program has had a massive impact on AIDS in Africa. There's absolutely no doubt that millions of people are alive today because of that program that would not have been alive if that program had not been implemented. And
what is the program? Could you describe, I guess, just like describe the program for people who might not be familiar?
Well, the PEPFAR program, as you meant, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, which was started by George Bush too, was based on going to about 14 or 15 countries, and I think one or two were added later. But they include a large block of countries in sub-Saharan Africa with the highest rates of infection, and going to those countries to provide funds initially for treatment of patients with AIDS, and secondly, for prevention of mother-to-child transmission, and using antiretroviral drugs, the same drugs that are used to treat people with AIDS, have been used very, very effectively to prevent mothers who are HIV-infected from infecting their infants. And by the way, that's perhaps the first and clearest example of how treatment as prevention works. In the case of infected women who are pregnant, if you simply use the same drugs for treatment during that pregnancy, early enough in the pregnancy, you'll reduce to extremely low levels, like 1%, the chance that the woman will infect her infant, whereas without her being treated with those drugs, her chances are of infecting the infant are quite high, and that is, of course, directly associated with the viral load in the mother and the amount of virus released in the fluids. So that is one of the other major components of the PEPFAR program. And in a range of countries, including South Africa, Republic of South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Malawi, I'm not even sure Malawi is in it. It might be Zambia, but there's about 15 in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, a huge country. In all of those countries, programs were set up initially to get U.S. Investigators and AIDS experts involved in training people to do treatment on site in those places, and actually delivering drugs and expertise so the treatment could be done with specific targets according to each country's epidemic, so that X hundreds of thousands of people with AIDS at an advanced stage should be treated this year in that country, etc. And that has been extremely successful, as I said, in controlling HIV/AIDS, and is now expanding a little bit in two ways. One is to transfer more and more of the funds and expertise directly to the countries so that they're managed almost completely within the country. And the other is to use some of the funds to expand expertise at earlier levels, such as training programs in medical schools, so that more physicians and health experts would be trained to begin with in that country to provide such treatment.
So I guess, could you draw a straight line between the sort of passing of PEPFAR and sort of a reduction of AIDS incidence in Africa?
You could certainly draw a straight line between expansion of PEPFAR and reduction in AIDS deaths in Africa.
Okay.
I think you could probably draw a line in reduction of HIV incidence infections too, but you might have to wait a little bit longer, because remember, one of the hallmarks of HIV infection is it takes you 5 or 10 years to die after you get infected. And the initial focus of the program was on treatment of patients to prevent death, not on prevention of infection. That came second. And through treatment, you also get some prevention of transmission. But the initial focus, it's a big part of the focus now, but the initial focus was on keeping people alive.
Mm-hmm. And that was accomplished by just expanding the availability of treatment and reducing the costs of treatment, correct? Like, treatment used to be really expensive. And now I saw something that says it's basically like $140 per person per year.
Yes, absolutely. And it wasn't only PEPFAR that played a role. For example, I believe that the Clinton Foundation, for example, played an important role in lobbying pharmaceutical companies to lower their prices and negotiating with some of the generic pharmaceutical mm-hmm. companies to provide drugs in Africa. They may not have provided anywhere near as much to actually pay for drugs to treat patients in Africa, right. But that role was quite important.
Well, it speaks to the individual of Bill Clinton, though. I mean, the value, I mean, at least my understanding, the value
yeah.
of the Clinton Foundation in this sort of matrix of people fighting against AIDS is that he's a very persuasive character. And so
Absolutely.
You have sort of Bill Clinton sitting across the table from pharmaceutical heads, and he's being backed by funds from groups like Unitaid and the Global Fund to basically negotiate bulk purchasing. And it's obviously, you know, and I think that's the unique role, one of the unique roles, I think, that the Clinton Foundation and Bill Clinton has played in this story.
Yeah, I totally agree. They're using his strengths.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, another big thing to reflect on, sort of coming up, we're having the Global Fund Replenishment Conference happening in Washington, D.C. Or did it already happen? It's sort of around this time of year. And this is another, I think, advent of the Bush era that has helped to greatly inject new funds in the global fight against AIDS and the big three killers, AIDS, malaria, and TB. And this is basically an international pool of money that goes to countries to fight, those three killers. What role do you think has the Global Fund played since its advent in reducing AIDS and in helping the fight against AIDS?
Well, I think the Global Fund has also played an important role. They have focused on malaria and TB, as you say, not only on HIV/AIDS, and they couldn't, therefore, perhaps do quite as much on AIDS as PEPFAR could, but they could also focus on some of the countries that were not part of the original 15 or 16 or however number were selected for PEPFAR by the Bush administration initially. And I think they also play an important role in lobbying other countries to come to the table with some funds that might not be as likely to get involved in supporting AIDS and TB, et cetera, if it was just bilateral agreements that they had in place, as PEPFAR is, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in what role, I mean, obviously, like, the most important sort of, I guess maybe probably, like, the key variable in whether a country is willing and able to, you know, reduce its AIDS prevalence is the amount of sort of energy and effort and political will and funding behind that at the country level and at the local level. Things like PEPFAR and the Global Fund inspired countries to raise their own funds rework their own budgets in ways that are more supportive of AIDS? Or do they see it as something like someone else will pay for it, so we don't have to raise money, we don't have to budget for this?
There has been some of both, but on balance, I think there's been more of a positive role in convincing the heads of state and governmental structures of many of the countries that are eligible to do more themselves to get proportional help from PEPFAR. And I know at the very earliest stages, for example, there were some regions within larger countries like Republic of South Africa, where one region with a local government might be very, very interested in getting PEPFAR funds, but because the national government wouldn't endorse it, they didn't get them. And then over time, such pressure was put on that happened, and the national government realized that they had to do this for the to retain the cooperation from the citizens of the country, et cetera. So I think that there were rocky starts at the very earliest stages where some countries tried to limit it to a reason for them to do less with their own government. But I think within 3 or 4 years, there was a pretty good understanding of those countries getting the most out of it, that they had to come to the table, and that has certainly happened in countries that I'm quite familiar with, like Botswana.
So earlier you mentioned the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, and sort of at the last big AIDS conference, which happened to be in Washington, D.C., President Obama sort of announced, set this sort of goal of his support for an AIDS-free generation. Presumably to get an AIDS-free generation, you need to find all pregnant mothers who are HIV positive and prevent them from transmitting the virus to their children, which you said earlier, if done properly, if the treatment's available, can reduce that rate to about 1%, which is where it is in most developed countries, but it's obviously a much higher hurdle in other countries. Where are we in that, in sort of the prevention of mother-to-child transmission?
Well, we've made tremendous progress in most countries. And one of the reasons why I think that's an attainable goal is because in many of the poorest countries of the world, when healthcare is available at all, it's available first and foremost to pregnant women or to pregnant women and infants for purposes of reducing infant mortality rate and higher delivery rates of well and live infants, etc. So that if you go to most of the poorer countries in Africa, if you see anything at all in the context of healthcare in some of the rural places that have no hospitals, no physicians, etc., the first thing they have is maternal care in the context of pregnant women and giving vaccines to infants and such. Therefore, you've got a built-in situation, even before AIDS, with that population self-identifying into the healthcare system. Therefore, it's not that hard to test them for HIV, and if they're HIV positive, to give these drugs as treatment for prevention to prevent the infants from being infected. So I think for a range of reasons like that, that's the first goal and the easiest one to achieve.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but my understanding that it's relatively difficult, however, to test an infant. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
I think I was maybe last year or 2 years ago, I was at some hospital in Monrovia, Liberia, and they were saying how they had to send their test packets, their test results, to a lab in South Africa and get the test results back many, many weeks later. Just because the technology is expensive and sort of not very sort of widely available.
Yes, but testing infants isn't a requirement to invoke a program to demonstrate how dramatically you've reduced transmission to infants.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I mean, you need to test whether or not your strategy worked, right? I mean, you need to...
Yes, but you can do that quite readily by testing two-year-olds, for example. And then you buy this window of confusion where antibodies that were passively transmitted from the mother wash out of the infant blood system by a year of 14, 16 months at the most. And then the infant only has such indicators of positivity if the infant himself or herself is truly infected. But realistically, if you can get the blood sample from the infant, it's not that hard to do. I mean, I don't know exactly what Liberia does, but it's not that hard to do. It's a very simple PCR test. Mm-hmm. So that it's the same kind of PCR test that any diagnostic lab does for anything.
I wanted to, while we're on the subject, to ask you about AIDS vaccine and where we are in that, I guess, in progress towards that.
Yes. I have to say that I'm not as optimistic about our developing an effective vaccine against HIV/AIDS. At least one that would be available for the population within the next 10 to 12 years. And there are a couple of reasons why I'm not as optimistic about that. One is all of the approaches that we've tested to date haven't given sufficient positive results to say that more than a third or so of vaccinated people in trials, at most a third, could be protected, and even then, that usually doesn't account for the wide strain variation between viruses. So that I think we really don't know scientifically today how to make such a vaccine that would be truly protective. And secondly, we have realized over time that doing the trials take much longer than we expected. Doing the trials initially for toxicity to make sure we're not doing any harm takes several years, 3-4 years. Then doing immunogenicity trials to see whether or not the vaccine stimulates the immune response take another 3-4 years. Then doing a large-scale efficacy trial, if we get that far, would take another 3-5 years. So even if you had the right candidate in store today, it would take you 10 or 12 years to find out whether or not that vaccine, that experimental vaccine, was really efficacious. And I think that with the massive progress in such approaches as treatment as prevention and some other combination prevention interventions, that I would like to think that within 10 to 15 years, if we maintain the same progress in reducing incidence, that we might even be at a stage where it won't be that practical to give vaccines to large blocks of people anyway. It will still be practical to give vaccines to subsets of people who are at higher risk or in special situations. But personally, I don't think we can justify the same level of investment in vaccine research today that we could have 5 or 10 years ago, because some of the other opportunities like treatment as prevention are working so well. And I, believe me, I never dreamed that I'd make statements like that 10 years ago.
I mean, that I think speaks to something. I think that's such a profound part of the sort of story of AIDS, which is, you know, this was a disease threatening our species, you know, 30 years ago. Yet through a combination of ingenuity, generosity, changing our social policies, we've come to the point where we are getting a handle on this disease, and we are beating it. We are winning. I wanted to ask you, though, sort of, I guess, at what point or when, if you can make a prediction, might sort of incidence and might sort of the problem of AIDS in some of the high prevalence countries in Africa be about the same as they are in Western Europe or parts of the United States that aren't Washington, D.C., where the levels is sort of very high? So I guess, when can we start to see that sort of end of AIDS? That kind of dramatic decrease.
Well, I would predict that within 10 years, we'll see rates of incident infections in many countries in Africa to be even lower than places like Washington, D.C., because I think some programs for treatment have work, I'm just talking about treating clinical AIDS, have worked better in some countries in Africa than they have in Washington, D.C.
Why is that?
I think it's because health care diagnosis and delivery can be better organized in places like Botswana and Namibia, even Zimbabwe, than they are in Washington, D.C., and a lot of other places in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a lot of, you know, places in the U.S. like Boston or smaller cities, Denver, Seattle, you know, mm-hmm. where there's more attention paid to such things.
So, I mean, this raises the question. So, if you see sort of this dramatic decline happening over the next 10 years. I guess, will there be sort of like sort of pockets of holdouts? I mean, I know that the global health community likes to talk about most at high risk populations, which tend to be injecting drug users, men who have sex with men, or sex workers. Those kind of three groups are often targeted for specific interventions because prevalence is much higher in those groups than in the population at large. Do you think sort of, I guess in a way, AIDS will go back to being a disease that's concentrated in those limited populations?
Yes.
Which is kind of where it almost started?
I agree with that, although the limited populations themselves won't be as numerous as they were before. But yes, I do agree with that in general. And when you think about implementing any health prevention scheme, polio vaccines, for example, with worldwide eradication of polio, your inevitable problem, not necessarily for reasons of sexual behavior, obviously, your inevitable problem is small groups of people who are not part of the system. And as long as you have a lot of stigma around either AIDS or sexual practices, you'll have some of those groups in some places in the world, more in some places than others, and therefore you'll have these foci of higher rates of HIV infection. They'll spill over to the population at large to some degree. So I don't ever see, certainly not in my lifetime, not in the next 50 years, eradication of HIV from the population.
But it could reduced to such a level that it sort of, that it sort of, effectively, in places like I'm in Denver, effectively eliminated from the population at large.
Yes, absolutely. And people who are infected can be kept alive, living almost normal lives, and prevented from transmitting to others.
Dr. Max Essex, thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us for World AIDS Day. And this was fascinating. Wonky, but I think our audience will love it. So thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you.